Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com during those times, and we also archive these programs. They call them podcasts in the 21st century. I still refer to them as audio files or archives or what have you. Nonetheless, podcasts at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. Also at iTunes and SoundCloud.com. And I finally broke down. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I did the very thing I swore I never would do, but I've been told over and over again that it won't hurt much. I am now with Tell Me Your Story, the radio program. I am on Facebook. Yes, indeed. However, I don't spend a lot of time there. I have touched base with some of my friends from the radio days gone by back in Phoenix, and I only friend people I know, like my guest today. His name is John Jensen. He is the author of not only a book, but a philosophy, if you will, I think that you're going to find very interesting. It's called We Need a Movement, Four Problems to Solve to Restore a Rational Government. And John Jensen's my guest. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Richard.
I know that a lot of folks are kind of feeling that, regardless of which side of the current political spectrum you might be on. But overall, I would say that if you were to poll both sides, they'd both say, yeah, we feel and have felt for a long, long time disenfranchised from the system. That, you know, we're not getting the results we thought we would get. We're not going in the direction that we thought we would go. And I want to share a couple of things with you as we get started. And I'm going to ask you a couple of the questions that I did when we spoke before this program. I had an opportunity to speak with a gentleman who, he was a very conservative talk show host locally, has since passed away. And as I like to say now of folks who have passed, at least now he knows the truth. Okay? So we claim to, but, you know, until we get to the other side, we're not really going to. But I walked up to him after one of his programs one day, and I had two points to make. And the first one was, did you ever consider that you are part of the problem? And the reason is because you and your people did not get the vote out to elect the people you wanted in those offices, regardless of what they were, local or national and so forth and in between, so that they could then pass the laws and do all of the things that you think would lead us in the right direction. And, of course, he just looked at me with a look of, you're an idiot, which I took very proudly, I must say. And then the second point I made, I says, and don't you think you owe those people that you accuse of having a mental disorder? Because he wrote a book called Sad about that very fact that he felt that liberals and progressives and Democrats suffer from a mental disorder. And no joke. And I said, don't you think you owe them a debt of thanks and gratitude? Because if it wasn't for them, you'd have nothing to talk about. Okay. And then the third point I didn't bring up to him was, it seems to me, John, as you and I converse, that both sides wish the other side would just disappear and life would just be, oh, it would just be a paradise. But that isn't the reality. We all live here together. We have to find a way to work and function and in this hopefully civilized social environment. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, you raised a number of threads there. This last one, the polarization. I'd like to make a common sense point about the difference between conservatives and liberals. Okay. Mm-hmm. Basically, conservatives conserve. You hold on to something that you feel was a gain. Now, all of us, in order to sustain a stable life, have to be conservative to some extent. We hold on to the gains we make, so there's nothing wrong with that. Liberators, liberals, are saying, hey, we also need to progress. We need to be progressive. We need to find something else that's going to add to our life. Otherwise, if we just conserve, then we kind of stay with, you know, the Flintstone level. If we liberate too far, nothing holds together. So both of these sides really need the other side in order to obtain balance. Mm-hmm. So that's one point.
I like that.
Yeah. I think where the problem lies is in something I treat in detail in my book, which is confirmation bias. In other words, once you get to thinking that my side is right, okay, your side is right, but not absolutely over everything. But once you get a frame of reference where you that you feel is true, that you can buy into, you feel is going to lead you in the right direction, what you tend to do, what the mind tends to do, is to sort the array of evidence for things that lead in that direction. In other words, looking at myself, hey, I'm a creative person, I want certain outcomes. So then my mind says, well, that's what's important. So then I pick things out of the stream that lead me in that direction. So, for example, in the last lead up to the last election, just before the election, my wife and I were listening to a radio broadcast kind of detailing a little summary of the various polls. Well, my wife says to me, so who's going to win? And I said, well, the preponderance of the polls say that the Democrat is going to win. And she said, no, it said that the Republican could win. And so help me, I didn't hear anything in the broadcast that would have led to that conclusion. So both of us were operating within confirmation bias. This is what we were looking forward to happening. And so we selected out of the stream of words there, that just the things that confirmed us. And this is what people do all the time, and they don't realize how natural a thing it is. It's part of being a creative person. You steer your focus. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have a higher commitment to the best solution, even if I'm wrong, then we get led down these polarizing trails.
Now, I realize that this country's political process has been polarized long before Ronald Reagan came along. Mm-hmm. But it has been said by some that he is responsible for the increased polarization when he eliminated the fairness doctrine in broadcasting. Because now you don't have to give equal time to the other side. You can just spout off all you want and criticize. And I wonder sometimes, and we'll get into these four issues that you focus on in your book as well. But I wonder sometimes how this helps our civilization to, and when I say civilization in this context, I am speaking of specifically of the United States. But I know that this your book, in terms of We Need a Movement, could apply in other parts of the world as well. But we're going to try to keep it simple and stay focused on our own. But it just seems to me, I don't see how this kind of dialogue and rhetoric and vitriol and all of the other words you can throw in there is beneficial to the process of achieving what we want as a civilization. And it seems as though people are more vested in, to use this terminology, more vested in the party rather than the people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, there's a basic trait involved, which is that our personal experience is far more weighty for us than abstract ideas. And so if we collect to a group of people, hey, these are my people, we then start enforcing, affirming the ideas that are common to our group of people. So let's say it's a political party or a political sub-party. And it then places a boundary between us and the other people. And our natural tendency is to say, well, we just need to force this thing, push this thing farther and in all the ways that we can. Now, this is the core principle of my book, is that a lot of these problems are systemic. Mm-hmm. You cannot solve them just by a fraction of the population gaining more power. You know, think climate change, pollution, international relations, gun control, economic inequality, immigration, et cetera. All of these things and many more are systemic. So where people are working their heads off, I mean, they're exhausting themselves with a particular issue. Okay, now it's gun control, or is it white nativism, or whatever. They really want change, but they fail to recognize that the real forces that keep things as they are systemic. Now, this was kind of the one of the key points that generated in me the desire to get this book written,
mm-hmm.
was discovering the lifetime work of a historian named Arnold Toynbee back in the early, mid part of the last century. He wrote a 10-volume series on the study of history. And his question was, what is it that causes civilizations to rise and then fall?
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were successful for hundreds, even thousands of years. What made them come apart? And what he found was the most powerful issue was that initially, a creative minority put the country together, put the civilization together. They said, everybody, let's pitch in and do this. You know, get water, get agriculture, defend from enemies, etc. We're working together, and everybody had a place. What changed was they turned dominant, and they simply rode on the labors of others. And so then people could say, hey, this isn't working for me here. I mean, those guys are getting all the benefits, and I'm struggling along, barely able to feed myself. And so when issues then arose, as they always do, the will of the group was fractured, and they could not sustain their difficulties and went to pieces. Now, recently, Paul Krugman, you know, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, wrote a little piece on how Rome fell. I think it was mid last year. And he explained some of these issues of how Rome came apart from this governing body that really did not meet the needs of everyone. And he said, this is happening to us. And he did not see in the current social scene any forces able to withstand the same outcome as happened to Rome. Now, in the last election, you saw a generalized anger at the establishment. Everybody thought, well, the establishment is a problem. We got to drain the swamp, etc. Well, yeah, folks, that on both the left and the right. I mean, Democrats and Republicans were basically saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But here we are, you know, neck deep in the swamps. So things have not changed. And so, you know, our question then is how to go about making this systemic change. And what I believe I've done is to establish a template. Here's the discipline, folks. If you consider yourself a leader and you are working at a problem, and the problem has a lid to it because overarching forces or influences are keeping it the way it is, we need to go to the overarching forces. We need to change the system in a more global manner. And this is what a movement is. That's what movements are about, changing mm-hmm. things in a broad way that allow other, more detailed changes to take place.
Yeah. Now, I've been accused over the years, and maybe it's because as I get older, and I've heard this cute little line, especially when folks get in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, they don't care what they say anymore, because what are you going to do? You know, you can't hurt me. I'm too old.
Right.
I'm going out very soon anyway.
Right.
Well, I've been accused, and in a kind way, of basically speaking from where I am coming from as an observer watching things going on and expressing the very logical, very practical and pragmatic assessment of what's going on to the consternation of others. They don't want to hear it. And I'm not saying I'm right. Please don't get me wrong, folks. I have no corner on correctness here. I'm trying to figure it out just like everybody else, just like John is trying to figure out here in his book, We Need a Movement. And again, it's four problems to solve to restore a rational government. And you deal with the four problems, which happen to be meaning, self-power, mediocre thinking, and organization. And I'm not going to start with those four. I'm going to start with this question that I asked you when we were conversing before. You talk about these four problems to solve to restore rational government. So my question to you is, when did we last have rational government?
Well, good point. Maybe at the moment when Thomas Jefferson laid down his pen, maybe we had rational government for a few minutes there. But your point is so well taken, and this is one of the issues I deal with in the book, is the power of emotional entrainment. You get your emotional investment in being right about a particular thing, and the very idea that we need to be rational in order to get to where we want to be is not even respected. So yes, I really align with your point.
One of the things that is frustrating for me is, as I think I shared with you, I find it difficult to express, to exert energies in a direction that are not productive, that are not just for my benefit, but for the beneficial movement forward for everybody involved. It just seems as though, even on even on the lower levels of our civilization in the United States, and when I say that, I mean the general public, the laity, shall we say, okay? There is a disgust for people in different socioeconomic, educational, religious, political positions. Where there is absolutely no respect whatsoever for differences of opinion, no matter how small, you know. And, you know, as I was looking through the book, I'm thinking, okay, where's this guy coming from? I don't know if I want to take this on here. But as I looked through the materials and I looked through the book, I began to realize that you don't have necessarily an axe to grind politically on a particular spectrum. You just want to try to get us back to a place of, in my perspective, correct me if I'm wrong, a place where we could conceivably solve some of the problems. And I was sharing with a friend of mine last night on the phone as we got into the deep discussion of this. I said, you want to know, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, John, the solution that will help us to move forward is that everyone gets an education. This radio program is about choices and knowledge of those choices, right?
Okay.
If you don't know that you have other choices, you can't choose them. So people who, let's just say, are on the social programs, the entitlement programs, that's all they know. That's what they've been raised in. So they don't choose anything else because they can't get the kind of education that someone in position and or in power.
Well,
and
let me come in on that point, because I think that is really, really critical. One of the four factors of the book that I refer to there is the necessity to learn. Mm-hmm. Action, learning, and mutual support are kind of how we need to organize. Now, think of it this way. In order to send a vehicle to Mars or to the moon, there's a mental picture with a lot of details, but the picture itself has to be coherent. All the pieces need to support each other. Mm-hmm. Now, you think, well, wait a second now. We have this society running. Could it be that the picture we need needs to be as coherent, holding together, and as detailed? Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, think about all the things that, like you detailed there, that go wrong. One of the markers that I put in the book there that's kind of helped me stay on track was a comment made by Cesar Chavez, who worked, you know, not far from you in California there. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, he put out this enormous effort, you know, in organizing, and somebody asked him, well, was it really hard? And he said, organizing is easy. Just paint a picture and color it in.
Mm.
So you paint a picture. Here's the broad scope. But then coloring it in means each detail needs to fit the overall picture. And so this is kind of the organizing challenge, which I deal with in the fourth part of my book on organization. You really have to think in terms of the word you use, education, or think of it as development, how you are gaining ideas that then enable you to act in a way that brings the society into alignment. So there's a kind of a commitment, and this distinguishes what I see a movement needs to do from sheer political work. You know, sheer political work. Hey, we got this poster. We got to get it out. We have these yard signs. Got to get it out. We have these doors to knock on. We got to distribute these flyers, etc. No. You need thoughtful people who can weigh what people tell them and engage them in conversation and go back and forth until they reach a mutually satisfying conclusion. That's the difference. You need thoughtful people that know the details enough. Mm-hmm. So in the book, then, I lay out, here are easy ways to get to that point, how people learn in groups, reinforcing each other, talking about ideas, and there are models to do that that are not painful at all.
There's a philosophy that's not even 150 years old that I was a part of back in the early 90s. It was the Baha'i faith, and they have a very interesting dynamic in their we'll call them governing bodies. Mm-hmm. First of all, to become a member of one of these governing bodies, you are elected. However, you neither are nominated nor do you campaign. By virtue of your participation within the faith and within the community, as people see you participating, they will, in turn, they may very well nominate you and you may be elected, but it is of no conscious effort on your part, okay? The second aspect of it is, once you're a member, let's just say, John, that you had a problem. You would go to this member of this group of nine. And this group of nine, by the way, each one of them agrees as a member of this governing body, and I use the term loosely, agrees that when they begin to discuss your problem and try to come up with solutions, and each individual throws out an idea for a solution, that idea for a solution is no longer that individual's property. It now belongs to the collective. Okay?
Yes.
And so they will debate about it, and they may take a day, a week, a month, however long it takes to give you a solution, and they will give you this solution. It's up to you as to whether you follow through, and that they will say basically, and if this works for you, wonderful. If it doesn't, please come back and we'll revisit it and we'll talk about it again and we'll see what new ideas we can come up with.
You know, that model that you present there, you will find if you get into the middle part of my section on organization, it is modeled very much along those lines. I didn't start from thinking about the Baha'is, but simply from what works organizationally.
Mm-hmm.
Nominating people simply on the basis of whether you respect them or not was the way I suggested forming your local group planning team. And then the planning team does the same thing for nominating a chairman. And you expect every single person's ideas to be incorporated into whatever conclusions you come up with. And I explain the use, how important the use of a checklist, communications checklist, can be for just practically instantly changing the behavior of a group discussion so that the best ideas rise to the surface.
Well,
so that's good. Yeah.
And that, of course, we don't see any of that happening on the local or national levels in our legislative bodies.
Right, because
they're more concerned about saving face or preserving the party. And I think that your interesting point when I asked you about when was the last time we had a rational government, and that was when Jefferson put his pen down, and that was about it for a couple of minutes. I don't know if you would agree or not, but maybe the phrase, the analogy that our founding fathers would be rolling over in their graves if they could see what was going on, and the way that we no longer have servants who are in these offices serving the people. We now have people who have turned these things into full-time careers, which is not what was intended.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And that's very unfortunate in that respect, because we all lose, because are we getting close to 400 million people in this country? I know it's 350 or 375.
Yeah, it's the high 300s there.
We're getting there. And some people have even said that the Constitution was not designed to govern this volume of people. You only had 13 colonies when this thing was written.
Right.
You know, and I don't know if it was a million or 150,000. I don't know what the population was at that time. But it was certainly smaller than it is today, and so forth. So certainly there are a lot of arguments in a lot of different directions. So let's talk about these four problems. As I mentioned before, they are meaning, selfish power, mediocre thinking, and organization. Let's start with mediocre thinking, because if the educational system, as I was taught, and this was while I was still in it in the 70s, in grade school and high school, I was being told from outside sources that the educational system was being dumbed down. So I began to theorize. Okay, the textbooks come from people who write the textbooks, whether it's history or science or what have you. Well, if the system is being dumbed down, then the slippery slope has begun, so that if I'm going through and it's being dumbed down where I am, and it's going to be dumbed down further for the next generation and the next generation and the next generation, people that are coming out now in the 70s are going to be the ones to write the textbooks. Then the next generation of the 80s
well,
and so forth.
Before go we go any farther with that, the reason people do not know the reason why it was dumbed down. And it was really very simple when you get into the history of it. E.D. Hirsch pointed this out years ago, and then I tracked it down further. Mm-hmm. Back in the 1920s, you know, education prior to that time was really disciplined. Eighth graders had to know more than college students often do now, and about the world and nature and everything. Well, John Dewey came along, was a very persuasive person, and he had some very good ideas. But one of his big errors was he taught that learning happened by osmosis rather than by conscious desire to gather and retain information. In other words, you wouldn't need to worry about remembering anything, because familiarity would be enough. So I've written several books about education called the Practice Makes Permanent series, published by Roman and Littlefield, how you can turn any classroom around in a couple weeks if you start doing things differently. The key then is that if you believe that only familiarity is needed, then you can prepare. We're going to take a test in a couple weeks. Here's what's going to be on the test. Let's go over the answers. Everybody gets a good grade. Mm-hmm. And that's been happening ever since I was in high school in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And this expectation then that you can prepare children for a test, give them a test, and then forget about it. Basically, that was your final. The word tells kids, you don't need to even deal with this anymore. Well, this is totally contrary to what our scientific community depends on. Ivan Pavlov had this great line. He said, a scientist must accustom himself to the gradual accumulation of knowledge. Well, the masters of any field, I mean, whether it's medicine or law or history or whatever, they do that. They gather more and more and more knowledge, which enables us to have confidence in their judgments about these areas. But as you're pointing out, the dumbing down then is for all the rest of us who do not get through that barrier to get into something that is really intellectually challenging. And so we have this split between people the Dunning-Kruger effect, refer to. Two researchers found that the less people know, the more certain they are of their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they are too incompetent to understand their own incompetence.
But their incompetence is not coming from a lack of capacity.
Right.
It's
right.
A lack of exposure.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah. And the lack of the understanding, the discipline of how you gather knowledge and then how you use it.
Mm-hmm.
And how that can change society. So absolutely, it's part of this this theme I'm presenting here is the reason why you need a movement is actually to train people to think differently, to think with a range of knowledge and understanding where they can make a group work, where they can make a contact, where they can get across an idea to somebody who disagrees with them, rather than saying, hey, we just got to put up posters and cross our fingers and hope that our guy wins. It's not that simple.
There's a study Greg Braden has shared with us on this program in the past where he talks about this study where they put two groups of people together. One group was told, you are to achieve this result through competition. The other group says, you are to achieve this result through cooperation, and the quality of your work will be judged. The quality of the cooperation group was much higher than that of the competitive group.
Absolutely, yes. This is very familiar. Competition, in fact, they had found a study that in competitive situations, people are more likely to cheat.
Yeah.
Simply framing something as races encourages them to think in terms of how can I get an unfair advantage? So we have competition throughout our society, encouraging people to bend the rules as best they can in their favor.
I've even suggested that they have two sets of summer games and of the Olympiads and winter games. One is the drug-free and one is the drugged. Okay? Because
there's a rationale there. I get that.
Plus the fact, wouldn't there be more money? I mean, isn't that the whole goal of the Olympics in this 21st century is the whole all about money? It's not just about competition. So if you have two sets of games, okay.
You have twice as much betting.
You have twice as much betting and advertising and television coverage and so forth.
Right. Yeah.
We're going to jump into the next one. And again, we could go on probably for hours talking about this whole aspect of mediocre thinking. And I just want to throw one final statement that I was taught. I think it was back in my 20s, primarily because I was coming from a place of certainty, and I was still learning, and thank God I continued my education outside the walls of higher learning. And again, this is not to disparage higher learning. I wish I had gone to university or what have you. But the phrase, the quote that was given to me to kind of summarize all this was, it is better to begin in doubt and end in certainty than to begin in certainty and end in doubt.
That's great.
I have tried to live by that for as long, I tried to remember that. I still remember a conversation with one of my eldest sister, and of course we were getting into sort of a religious debate about my salvation, and this was going back, God, this is going back 20, 25, 30 years, and she was challenging me on my assertions and my position and so forth, and I finally said, you know what, my beliefs of yesterday are not my beliefs of today, are not my beliefs of tomorrow, because I am still learning and growing and experiencing, and I just don't know. I mean, even though I have a belief in a higher power, I would say I'm a believing agnostic, because I don't really know. I hope, I like to believe that there's an afterlife, but nobody really knows. And I hope and I believe that my life has meaning, and so I'm going to live my life that way, but it's just a gut feeling that I have, and I feel better living that way, knowing that it has meaning. She disagreed, of course, but nonetheless, that was okay, but we still talk quite a bit over that we have and have recently. Let's talk a little bit before we go to our break here in a few minutes. This is one of the aspects that I touched upon briefly when talking about people in power. Selfish power. The positions that were originally created by the founding fathers in the Constitution was supposed to be a position of service, and that you were supposed to be there for maybe one, tops two terms, and then you let somebody else have an opportunity to contribute. And it's turned into a full-time job where as soon as you are elected, your next job immediately after getting elected is to work on getting reelected.
Yes.
And so
indeed.
Forth. Let's talk about this whole aspect of selfish power both in government, but also we have this in business. We have this even in education, and to which I have never wanted to hold on to the information I have about how to run things. If I had a subordinate in my employ with a station I was working for, I wanted to teach them everything I could about what I was doing so that one day I could move on to other stuff. You know?
Yeah.
And learn something new and progress in my career and my abilities. So let's talk a little bit about that from this aspect of creating a new movement.
Well, the issue you raise is really really important there. You can look back at how the upper classes it framed our Constitution so that white property owners really dominated. Okay, so there's an inherently in our country there was a split right off the bat. Blacks could not vote and were counted instead in a manner that gave power to slave owners in the South. So the slave owner mentality really has influenced the very beginning of our country. Now, the World Wars, especially World War II, really equalized things in people's thinking, and that everybody needed to count. Everybody had to find a place, and everybody had to contribute. After that, things started to change. And in 1956, C. Wright Mills wrote this book, The Power Elite. And he was basically saying, hey, there is an establishment starting to form that really has undue power. 5 years later, President Dwight Eisenhower, on his farewell address, he explained the possibly disastrous accumulation of power in what he called the military-industrial complex. Actually, the military-industrial-scientific complex, where technology could kind of take over and gain even undue power without really stopping to intend it to do that. So then, with the Taft-Hartley Act in late 1940s, and these changes happening after World War II, the power of unions was severely, and the right to work laws that came in, the power of unions was undercut. And then Ronald Reagan came along in the right after World War II. Great changes in equalizing income, raising the bottom level. The poorest came up the most. Then Ronald Reagan actually made a theory, a plan, an expectation. If you help the top people, the rest will trickle down. And so the idea of rewarding those at the top became kind of enmeshed in our system.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point on, steadily, the statistics tell us this: the unequal inequality gap has grown steadily. And like from the time of the Great Recession in 2008, to 2012, 95% of the gains went to the top 5%. So it's like, or the top 1%, excuse me. And all the rest, are laboring under systems that just, there's closed doors everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a scary thing that came up was in Google X company, apparently they study these trends and so on, and the president of Arizona State University was cited as talking to one of these people who said that in the next 10 years, 30% of the jobs will be gone. And the reason why is because technology is really rapidly replacing anything that doesn't require refined judgment. In other words, anything that is a repetitive action, you can get a machine to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, why wages remain kind of stuck and people are just, 2/3 of the population basically are living paycheck to paycheck, that's not going to get better because there are going to be more people at the bottom level of the learning curve, mm-hmm. who are having a hard time finding a place.
Yeah.
So the system basically is set up, in other words, in all kinds of small ways to enhance not only the wealth and benefits of the upper class, but their power. You know, think about the Citizens United and the power of money now to skew people's perceptions of what is true. So we're stuck in the middle of this structural arrangement here, and it is so obviously systemic. It has to do with overarching plans and strategies set in place by Congress and typically the Republican Party, but also the Democrats are complicit in many ways, because that's how they think. You know, the establishment is where the power lies, so that's what you have to care to. So that's the people that we listen to. So anyway, that's my little wrap on on the influence of selfish power here. I know there's a lot to swallow there, but
indeed, and I have to say that it's also, and again, this just being my observation, and I'm not one of those who says, we need to do away with capitalism and the free enterprise system, but there are two major flaws that have come about over the decades in those two systems that are sort of work together. They're kind of the same name, two names for the same thing. Number one is greed. That is a part of the equation that nobody seems to want to talk about, and it's part
yeah.
of the equation. You can't deny that it's there, and it has to be addressed. There's another, and then, of course, that goes to the selfish power aspect that we were talking about. But there's another part of it, too, that made no sense to me. And again, I was thinking about this, believe it or not, either in eighth grade or in my freshman year in high school, and I began to start processing, because I was on the verge of being out there in the work world. And I'm thinking, okay, let's say I go to work for a company, and let's say that at that time you stayed at a place for as long as you could. Your dad would stay at a
yeah.
company for 20, 30, 40 years.
Right,
and
right.
you'd hope that over the course of that time that you would get incremental raises in pay. And thinking, okay, all right, let's just say you do. Let's say that the company gives you an incremental raise every year or every 2 years and so forth. Where does the money come from to increase your salary or your hourly rate? Well, it has to come from somewhere. They either lay off other people so that you make more money, but they need the people to continue to produce the product or service. So the other option is to reduce their profit margin. The third option is keep the profit margin where it is, raise the price of the product or service. Okay, fine. You raise the price of the product or service. So now the general public goes to buy your product or service, and they have to pay more. Well, they need more money. So they go to their employer, and they say, I need more money. So the employer gives them more money, and they're, of course, producing a product or service. And you see where this is going.
Right.
This is an unsustainable mathematical equation. It can't go on indefinitely, and of course, again, if you keep people uneducated, they're going to do what would we consider the menial job. Some people say flipping burgers or working janitorial service, and why should they get $15 an hour here in 2018? When it's not supposed to be a lifelong job. Well, it turns out to be a lifelong job.
That's the scary part.
Because they don't have the education to get out of that particular situation. So, those are some interesting dynamics that, we could talk about. But I want to talk about the other two pillars, if you will, in your thesis here, meaning and, of course, organization. And we're going to do that when we come back. I want you to stay with us. I also want to let our listeners know, too, not only do we broadcast this program Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. And of course, the podcasts are at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page, as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. But usually there is what's called an after view. The program only runs 50 minutes on the radio station. However, there's usually more. So we encourage you to go to richarddugan.com, the radio shows page, listen to the whole interview. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned.
Tell me your story. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're looking for the choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We're trying to look for those new ways of living because all you have to do is look around you. The old ways aren't working. It's pretty obvious that that's the case because of the disparity between the haves and the have-nots, or the educated and the uneducated, or what have you. There was something I wanted to bring up in light of these four issues that you raise in your book, in terms of course, the fact that people need to understand how to turn public indignation and long-term purpose into long-term purpose. I want to get your, because I don't know that you really address it in your book, but you may have in other works or articles. From your perspective as a human being, as an individual with your own philosophical bent, if you will, what do you see? What is your gut feeling, if you will, about the spiritual, and I say metaphysical, if you will, whatever other words you want to use, non-tangible, esoteric, health of our country today?
Oh, goodness. It's hard to judge other people. Root belief I have about people is that everybody is doing, by and large, the best they can. And so how they focus that effort into productive or destructive patterns is up for grabs. It is a creative zone, and I would not want to categorize the nation as a whole. I feel that in general there is a higher level of frustration now than I remember for decades past, but it's hard to translate that into a moral level.
Yeah. But I mean, there's got to be. I get the sense that we're in a manner of speaking, at one level, we are floundering.
Yes, absolutely.
To even use the gentleman you spoke of, whose name I'm not recalling, who talked about other civilizations that have gone down the path we are on right now.
Toynbee.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to use that to its logical conclusion. I don't see much hope for this country in 30, 40, 50 years. It certainly isn't. It just, unless we have some kind of a national epiphany, some kind of awakening.
Richard, keep talking about that, because that is absolutely aligned with the intent and purpose of my book. Yes.
All right. So how do we tap into that epiphany, my friend? Because certainly you've got these four problems that we need to deal with. And of course, we're going to talk about organization as well as meaning. But I guess that's, well, we want to try to keep it somewhat positive and uplifting.
Yeah. How to do that? There's a fundamental human trait, which distinguishes us from other animals, apparently, which is imagination.
Mm.
And humans are constituted to be able to transmit a picture to someone else, and they can say, that looks beautiful to me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was going through some old notes last week, and I ran across this note that I had written out by hand and put a big circle around it. Unless you are pursuing something beautiful, you are likely to lose your way. Well, to me, that really is the underlying theme here of what Cesar Chavez was saying. Paint a picture and color it in. Mm. But that operates even on the one-to-one level. In other words, if you say to your friend, hey, let's you and I have a meeting on Sunday at the church and go down Saturday afternoon and pass out some flyers to it. Here's what we can talk about at the church, okay? Well, if you can make that picture look good to your friend, then you have doubled your effort here. You and your friend are going instead of just you alone. And that works. See, the more people that there are, you get this sense of, oh, we all believe this. And how people change, in fact, the most simple, clearest, forceful way people change is by joining a group that has a vision and they act on it together.
Mm-hmm.
So these three factors, joining, vision, and acting. A lot of groups have, they join, and there's a vision, but they don't act on it. In other words, they say, oh, it's enough that we here believe this.
Mm.
Maybe somebody else will get it by accident. No. The whole idea of a movement is you're going out and communicating something.
Yeah.
You're communicating a vision, and it has to be beautiful. And in fact, the element of the value of it really is directly in proportion to the amount of sacrifice you will do for it. How hard will you work at this? Well, how hard you'll work depends on really how important you think it is. And so you think about, you know, generations and centuries of religious missionaries putting their life on the line. Hey, I'm going to go to India, Africa, you know, Indonesia or whatever, put my life on the line because this is supremely important to me. Well, if we're not at that level of, you know, a cosmic value, at least you can say, you know, I really want the world to be better for my kids,
mm-hmm.
and they're my grandkids, etc. That's enough for me to put out some time every week now to bring about this vision that I have for how society could work together.
Mm.
And that's really the core issue and the first problem I deal with, which is the problem of meaning. I express that in the phrase, the good of the whole. In other words, you have to think in systemic terms, but you have to think about the good, how the enhancement of all the pieces in that whole, whether it's animals, bugs, or fish, or people, old people, young people, sick people, disabled people, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good we can help towards. So that's the basic commitment then that drives even your interest in reading the rest of the book to
mm-hmm.
me.
Well, and of course, some people would sit there going, well, what are you talking about bugs and stuff? Well, the one thing that I learned over the years, and this I'm serious about this, that I learned with a men's group that I started back in 1993. The one thing that I learned when we would go out into the wilderness and we hiked into the Superstition Mountains east of Phoenix and a lot of other places around the area, and one of the guys that was with us always talked about the ecosystem we were walking through, and he would point out different plants and this and that and the other, and basically we all came to the same conclusion that he was sharing with us. You remove one element from this ecosystem and it dies. Or it changes.
Isn't that interesting?
It
yes.
changes.
Yes.
It's like playing that game with the wooden blocks. Is it Django or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And you start removing the blocks, and eventually mm-hmm. the person who removes the block that causes it to tumble, that's what
right.
happens to the ecosystem.
Right.
That's what happens in families. When someone leaves, someone dies. I have a 16-year-old Shepherd Husky mix female who can't walk. I have to carry her everywhere she goes, inside and outside. I know she's on her last legs, but I know that there's going to be a big hole left, and we're going to have to figure out how that dynamic is going to change in the household.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What you're talking about is so real.
Yeah.
My wife and I, we often work on projects together around the house. And a lot of times it's you might call it a major project. And so we have to think about it and really take the philosophy measure twice, cut once. Well, my wife speaks in, I'm going to say, a different language. It's still English, but, and she would, I think, be okay with the fact that I would tell people she's dyslexic. So she sees things differently. So she
uh-huh.
uses different words, and
right.
I have to repeat to her what she said to me in my words so that we both will understand each other and say, ah, and we're both on the same page. This
uh-huh.
is part of, you know, getting in my, hopefully I'm observing this correctly, understanding the meaning that the other is trying to express.
Yes.
And we have
yes.
to go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until we finally come to that consensus. Aha, I get what
right.
you're saying. I get
yes.
where you're coming from.
Yeah. Well, this issue is really kind of in the what we do differently in if we want to achieve these goals that we're talking about here, how to communicate with people who disagree with us, And I spend a good deal of time in the book tackling that question from several angles.
Mm. Okay, well, talk about the angles, if you will, because one of the things that I am really working very, very hard on is to understand what is going on in our world, putting a, I don't want to say a spin on it, but putting it through my logical thinking brain to understand where we're going to wind up if we do this thing. And then that, of course, always raises this question. Just because we can, does that mean we should?
Right, right. No, it doesn't. Right.
Yeah.
Well, about ways to approach this thing, there's a study that was really significant, in a small way. Why are people unable to talk to each other about really simple things? Mm-hmm. Just why is it closed off? Well, this one research team, found that people's brains actually work less efficiently when they're dealing with contradictory or contrasting viewpoints. So if I say one and one is two, and you're thinking, no, one and one is three, that difference between how we're seeing it causes the other person's brain to kind of like throwing a rock into a gear shift. There's a little sketch in there where they don't quite know where to go next.
Yeah.
And so it's less efficient. So if you start off with somebody focusing on areas of agreement, then you pursue this, yes, yes, yeah, and that, yeah, right. So the example given in the study was, if you're talking with somebody who is insisting that vaccination causes autism or whatever, so you start off with the idea, isn't it wonderful that a vaccination cures or prevents measles and mumps and rubella? Isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, we agree on that. Okay, mm-hmm. Now let's then proceed carefully, step by step, into the issue of vaccination and autism. The fact that we're working in alignment, then, mm-hmm. is portends better results from that point on. So how can we come into alignment with anybody who disagrees with us dramatically? Very simple. Listen to them. Take fascination in how they form their mind. For example, I was thinking, now, who would be hardest for me to listen to? Okay, if I'm facing somebody, let's say I'm sitting next to somebody on a bus or in a sporting event, and this person says some really racist things, how would I approach that? I'd say, you know, I've never really had a chance to talk to somebody who felt the way that you do. I'd really be interested in hearing how you came to that viewpoint.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. Now, was it your dad? Was it your ancestors? Places you lived? What influences? Oh, so you really like to be around people that are the same as you. I can understand that. I like to be around people that are the same as me, too. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Mm-hmm. So then you hear out their whole story. Well, listen to them, say, 10 minutes for every 1 minute you speak. And then when you do speak, you know exactly the point to make. Hey, you know, could I tell you how my parents influenced me and then how I changed my ideas from what my parents taught me? So you get into a conversation then about how these influences work on each of us.
Yeah.
So that's a very simple beginning.
And what's interesting is the goal, as you've described it, isn't to try to change this other person's perspective.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So now this person doesn't feel threatened or attacked. He or she actually feels included.
Right. People value when we are fascinated with how they think and believe. So we're following curiosity, which is a very natural kind of thing. Now, here's how one way that this was applied in canvassing. You know, this was the spear point of a movement. If you're going to go out and give ideas to people, knock on their door, how would you do that? Well, start off by saying, you know, I'm here about the coming election, and would you tell me about X, whatever it is you want to bring up. Listen to them for 10 minutes and then ask a question about how the issue affected them. Now, they use this in regard to changing people's viewpoints about transgender issues. Mm-hmm. And they found that asking people their own experiences of being discriminated against changed their attitude on follow-up studies. You know, how did this person then think about this later? By something like, 10 or 11% of the people actually changed their thinking about it, simply based on a conversation where the canvasser did most of the listening and then inquired how that issue affected the other person. So you could apply that to, you know, I don't know, immigration, healthcare, education, et cetera, anything you wanted to bring up. Do a lot of listening and then get how the other person applies those ideas.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, another real basic thing that I think would be very helpful in a lot of small towns, you know, there are 16,000 small towns under 25,000 people.
Wow.
And in those size towns, lots of people know a lot of other people, mm-hmm. and their families, and so they're already relating on a variety of levels. So you get a big room, and you announce to people, hey, bring a book about something that interests you, and we're just going to trade ideas here. So you pair people up with somebody that they didn't know well before, read for 10 minutes, and then share back and forth what you just read. Everybody stands up, finds a new partner, read more, or share what you already got, and cycle of reading then and sharing with a new person, reading and sharing with a new person. And I've done this with a large group, and it just creates this bubble of energy, and I believe that it is a way to heal polarized political viewpoints. If people bring a political statement of some kind, a book or whatever, they're sharing information. They're actually forming an idea based on what somebody else wrote. Or there's something then that's objective rather than it simply depending on which of us can assert our idea better. So I really believe it has potential for healing a lot of division. I call it the study and share method.
I call it tell me your story, because that's kind of what we do here. We have folks on like yourselves who put out your ideas. We lay out this smorgasbord, and we ask people to come and partake. We're not saying that you're going to like everything. Don't take everything. Only take what resonates with you, and
sure.
Then you can come back again and again and again. Maybe tomorrow that you might like to try that, at least take a taste, and you may like it, you may not. I used to say this, and I used to say it somewhat flippantly, usually at the end of the program, where I would say to folks that if you've been listening to this interview, it's too late. You've already heard the information. Now you have to deal with it because you can't unhear it. And someone said to me, says, well, that's not very nice, you know, but it is true. And that's why I encourage people, be careful, be mindful of what it is that you are taking into your body, whether it's food, drink, movies, television, books you read, people that you associate with. But at the same time, didn't you ever hear the phrase when you were a kid growing up, going to school, you know, something along the lines of go to the library, read a book and broaden your horizon, something along those lines?
right, of course. Yeah.
And yet now we have on television and radio, we have what they call the echo chamber, where you only hear people who are speaking the words and phrases and ideologies that you agree with.
Right.
Where's
yeah.
the broadening there?
Right.
That's why I've been a strong proponent. I actually wanted to do an interview many years ago in working at a Christian station in Phoenix. State legislature was working on a bill to give gay rights, you know, and I wanted to have representatives from both sides to discuss this. And this, again, on a Christian station. So I called the local head of the Ex-Gays for Jesus group, and he refused, says, I don't want to give the devil equal time. I said, we're not giving the devil equal time. We want to talk about this as far as the pros and the cons. What's this going to mean for our society? I didn't have a dog in the fight. It didn't matter to me which way it went because I didn't feel threatened. But obviously, folks, you know, they do take those kinds of positions. This, to me, is again, we could... We've already gone an hour, and we could go on for another hour or two. And I just, I am so grateful for you coming forward with these ideas. I want to let our listeners know that Dr. John Jensen explains in his book, and the book is entitled We Need a Movement, Four Problems to Solve to Restore Rational Government, and explains why prior efforts to generate a movement have not succeeded. Are we talking about movements like in the 60s, in particular, civil rights movement? Movement and those kinds of things, ERA movement and what have you. Are those the kinds of movements, or is there something other that I'm missing that I have not observed yet in terms of these other unsuccessful?
Well, before answering that, let me comment on your announcement about my book title. If people go to my website, movementwithoutgunfire.com, they can get the book free.
Ooh.
There's a free download of a text. I want as many people to have it as possible, so I keep the price of the book low, $13, but also you can get it free.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay. One of the about your question about movement, see, there's a complete range of the numbers of people who align with an idea. You know, you have a Million Man March, or you have 100,000 women for women's rights, or the Me Too movement, etc. And these kinds of, I would say, campaigns, you distinguish a campaign to achieve a specific goal. And in her book, Rebecca Solnit, Hope in the Dark, Untold Possibilities, something like that, Untold Possibilities. She details movements or campaigns that have achieved great efforts in different countries and in our own history. But she concludes the book by saying, our problem now is systemic, and nobody knows how to change the system. Well... My book is an answer to that question. Here's how to change the system. You have to think in terms of the system, and you can really give the term movement to anything. I mean, you know, people gather for a couple of weeks, and all of a sudden they call it a movement. Well, that's just because there are numbers of people that think this is worthwhile making a noise about. But the movement, as I consider it, really is a different thing. It is how you develop people over time to sustain a direction, a picture, implementing a picture that may take generations or hundreds of years even.
I'm very excited about having you on the program here today. And of course, again, that website is movementwithoutgunfire.com.
Yes.
All right. And the book is entitled We Need a Movement, Four Problems to Solve to Restore Rational Government. Dr. John Jensen's been my guest, and I thank you so much. And if you should ever find yourself here in Santa Barbara, we would love to have you on the program to continue this conversation in person. I love doing that kind of thing. And then the second thing is I have three final questions for you, if I could. The first one is, who is John Jensen?
Oh, you know, I was a Catholic priest in Monterey, just shortly north of you, and have been in Santa Barbara many, many times. And it was there that I got this sense of organizing techniques that could make a huge difference just in my parish. And so that led me to eventually to trying to implement these ideas with a leave of absence, and then a lot of changes, getting more education, finally becoming an educational consultant and clinical psychologist. So right now I'm working as a clinical psychologist and continuing to write and think about the issues that have bedeviled me for decades now.
You and me both. I've got all kinds of those kinds of questions that have been bedeviling me as well. So
yes,
maybe I'll put out something along the same lines one of these days. Although it
Good
took me 17 years to at least come to a level of completion of my first book, which is a small little tome. We're not even talking 100 pages. But it took me 17 years, and I'm still trying to get the thing finished up. The second question for you is, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
The outcome must be, in my view, a changed norm, an expectation among the populace in general that the good of the whole must be our uniting factor. And then organizing, small groups organizing all over the country, affecting then how people operate their political efforts, focusing their political efforts on these kinds of issues.
And I noticed you never used the word or derivatives thereof, agenda. It's not about agenda.
Agenda is this kind of micro piece of the overarching issue, which is, do we have the will to take a lot of agenda items and just handle them? Once you decide, hey, we can handle this, it can go bing, 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 and you got a bill out through Congress in 2 weeks. One of the focuses I put out there is aim to change 536 people, Congress, Senate, House of Representatives, and the presidency, so that you can really look at the system as an overview and a balance of values that have to be taken account of.
Yeah. And finally, what is your life's purpose?
You know, my life's purpose is to be responsive to what I feel is the inner guidance that I get. I began as a Catholic priest in my adult life, and I still think that the moral issues about how we treat each other are the determining factor in the quality of our lives. And what drives me is simply trying to be observant and listening carefully to what I feel is the guidance that I get. As much as I tend to distort it and hammer it into the shape that my own emotional entrainment and confirmation bias and limited thinking confine me, they're just trying to break out of that envelope to do what works best for everyone.
You know, I often tell people during the interview as well as outside the confines of the studio that this is my therapy. And so I'm hoping that I'm getting better, doctor.
good. Well, I see good signs here.
Oh, very good. Dr. John Jensen.
You're rooting for the right things.
Absolutely. Well, we're doing our very best, and we're grateful for folks like you who are giving us new ideas to consider, devoid of a lot of the charged words that are really driving a lot of what's going on radio and television and even in the newspapers and on the internet as well, and giving people ideas that I think are extremely productive, very positive, that could hopefully turn the tide. And maybe as Ev Meekham, who was running for governor in Arizona back in, I want to say the 80s, maybe it was the early 90s, he made a comment during the campaign that most great civilizations only lasted 400 years and America is going to be different. And I just thought, really? What makes you think that? Because even then, it didn't look real hopeful. But
yeah.
I don't want to give up hope. And I thank you for sharing your vision of hope with our listeners through We Need a Movement. Movementwithoutguns.com is the website. And John.
So, Movement Without Gunfire.
Gunfire.
Movement Without Gunfire. Gun.
We'll be linked to you, by the way, so people can just click there. And also,
okay.
The interview will be available on the website as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. And Dr. John Jensen, thank you again for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Richard. Bye.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.